Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode will cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
And we have a pro with us today, which our listeners will be so surprised about because it's interview day. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did it.
I got him. Whether you know him from his role as Booker DeWitt in Bioshock Infinite, Joel in The Last of Us, the Joker in Batman Arkham Origins, Batman in Telltale's Batman games, Sam Drake in Uncharted 4, or Hawkeye from Marvel's animated series, chances are you do know him. We are excited to have actor and singer Troy Baker with us. Troy, how are you?
Dude, I'm not going to lie, man. I love listening to people's intros because it's always a surprise. I'm like, what are they going to pull up? Like, you can kind of always... There's a couple of staples. You're like, all right, they're going to bring up Joel. They're going to bring up Booker. And it's always like everything else is a little bit of a grab bag. You're like, who? No, cool. Okay. They did mention that. So I'm always a big fan of hearing people's, I guess it's kind of like a precursor to like who this person is that I can kind of gauge. It's a little different with you, Footer, because I mean, like there's like history there just kind of going back, but because I know what I'm getting in with you, because this like our conversations that we've had, which have been brief, and typically it's kind of like, you know, industry event passing whatever, mm-hmm. but it's always like whenever there's a cause for us to exchange paths. Amanda, I'm curious to see kind of with your, I'm going to end up interviewing you guys, but it's always been like there's a critical, you know, crossroads in the industry and there's a conversation that's happening. It's like, well, pretty much here we're at there now.
Yeah. Like,
what are we going to talk about today? But I am happy to be considered a pro by you guys. And I'm happy to have a conversation with you today.
Well, we're so grateful to have you here. And to be honest, I almost threw Kenji in. From Persona 4.
Yeah,
but I did just now. So technically I did it.
You did it.
Yeah.
I did it.
You 100% did it. Oh, I was disappointed too, actually. I totally forgot about that.
Well, damn, that's Pharaoh. Me. I'm just here to disappoint.
Oh, buddy.
I don't like that. I know I laughed, but it was kind of an awkward, like, upset laugh. That was my Canadian way of masking my feelings.
Oh,
we're learning things today.
Oh, yes.
We are definitely learning things today. Okay, so Troy, the way that we normally start this is something that I've batted back and forth with a lot of the interviews I've done over the 10 years that I've been in this industry. And Mike's like, hey, we should do this for all of our interviews. So I want to know, and everybody wants to know, your origin story. How did you come to work in the game industry? Tell us your sordid or not so sordid tale.
The medium sorted. It's funny because, yeah,
that's fair.
Everybody, this is the number one question I think people ask me, at least now, before it was, is there going to be a sequel to The Last of Us? We finally answered that question. So we moved on, but everybody wants to know, how did you get into this and why is it almost like it happened upon me? And in a lot of ways it did. I was a musician. I thought that's how I was going to light up the world was through my music. And then lo and behold, no, that's not at all what was going to happen. And I found myself, and I was still doing that. And I was ignoring the fact that there were other opportunities that were presenting themselves until finally we were recording our album at this studio and they were like cutting drums or whatever. And down the hall was this other studio that they like did, you know, car commercials at. And so I just kind of was wandering down the hall like I owned the place and walked in the door and I was like, hey, I want to be on the radio. And they're like, hey, get out of here. And they literally kicked me out. And then 2 weeks later, they said, if you still want to do this, let's see what you can do. And so they brought me in and I did. The guy was like really, really rude to me. And he was like, pick up the pieces of copy. That's the words on the page. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm at least, you know, somewhat intelligent and literate. Walked into the booth. He goes, let me see what you can do. And it was a like this Sunday, that kind of thing. So I just did that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you're very easily amazed or very, very kind, because it's not. It's just me emulating what I'd always heard on the radio. And I did different stuff. I was like, what about this medical thing? It's like, ask your doctor about Prokesia and what Prokesia can do for you. So stupid stuff like that.
Wow.
There wasn't a lot of like, ooh, creative. I didn't go to school. I didn't really consider myself an academic. I've done everything that I've learned after that has been either on the job training or retroactively just trying to become better at what I do. Because typically I make a mistake. I'm like, okay, what can I do to never make that mistake again? And it's either the relationships that I have with the people and people's patience and them being willing to go, let me show you a better way of doing what I want to do. Because by and large, what they recognize is that I'm nothing if not passionate. And I really, really care not only about what I do, but I really care about my dog barking at the postman coming. Which is like,
I'm just happy that your dog went before our dogs. Because ours, they're regular guest stars.
Yeah.
Yes, well, it's true.
This is the beauty of quarantine. It's like, oh yeah. And you'll hear my son come. My favorite is like, I'll be in the middle of a podcast, whatever. My son just walks into my room. He's two and he's fat. Oh, no, you have no idea. He's 10. My son has like hair that's below his shoulders. Blonde. He's a towhead. He's got the brightest blue sky, blue eyes. But he'll come in and he'll go, G, and I was like, okay. And he's letting me know what letter the poop that he just made in the toilet makes. And I was like, so I've had all these podcasts. And I was like, J, little J. I was like, oh, it was a little J. I was like, way to go, bud. And I agreed. So
amazing. That is so good. That reminds me of our youngest.
Oh man. How old are they? You have two?
We have four.
We have four total. So my biological kids are 16. Oh, she's 16 now. Oh my God, she turned 16.
Holy crap.
Yes.
This was during the pandemic, she turned 16.
She sure did.
And 11, almost 12. And our other two kids, Amanda's biological kids, are 8 and 7.
Mm-hmm. Almost 9.
Oh my God. So
yeah, almost 9.
You know the twos. You know,
and
probably
yes.
Miss the twos.
Sometimes
it's everyone's like, oh, the terrible twos. I'm like, they're not terrible. They're
threes
just,
you got to look out for.
You gotta, yeah. Sorry, dude.
No. It's all good. I'm ready. Everyone was like, oh, 6 months, they're great, but wait till they're 9 months. And it's like, 9 months, they're awesome. Wait till a year. And there's like been challenges along the way, but I really think that we got like, it's trust me. My wife is an amazing parent. She's an incredible mom. And she has just kicked quarantine's ass. Like my son can count in three different languages. He knows all of his ABCs. His vocabulary is off the chart. The best part of it, and this is what I'll kind of take some credit for, he has a favorite Beatles album.
Nice.
He's like, Sgt. Pepper's is his favorite album. It was Yellow Submarine, which obviously isn't off Sgt. Pepper's, of course, but I'm not going to correct him. Yellow Submarine was his favorite song. Now it's kind of Hey Jude, but then he's really starting to lean on Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and he'll sing these songs. So if you've never heard a two-year-old go, na, 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 Hey Jude, that makes me believe like in like Santa could be real too. That's, you know, like I feel like
I need video of this.
I will make sure that you have video of this because it's,
oh my gosh,
it's
you're
pretty
my hero.
Cool. He goes, Hey
Jude. That sounds awesome.
So anyway, my origin story
was not a little J.
Was not a little J. It was a big J. But no, I went in and I did the whole audition thing. And then it was pretty much just kind of like stumbling after one mistake and moving to the next. And I've fortunately been able to, because I work hard and because I'm diligent, people have continued to go, all right, we'll give you a shot with this. Because if nothing else, I've shown that if I make a mistake, I'll own it and try to never make that mistake again. I'll just be daring enough to make other mistakes. But I did these car adverts or whatever, and I was just kind of like side cash. It was fun. Mm-hmm. But I didn't consider it a career. I was just getting a couple of jobs because, again, I was going to be a rock and roll star. And then a buddy of mine who's also in the music scene in Dallas, because I grew up in Texas, and I'm like 20, I don't know, 4, 25 maybe at this point. He goes, hey, we're doing this game and you got a cool voice. Do you want to come and talking to a microphone and I'll give you some money for it. And I was like, yeah, dude, for games? Absolutely. And it was for Gearbox. It was this game called Brothers in Arms. It was my first lead role. And we recorded in a closet. They had to turn the AC off because otherwise the microphone would pick it up. And he and I would, even late at night, would be like, come up here and we're going to do these words. I was like, okay, what do I get? He'd scream, get down. And Corey, and over here, red on me, all of this stuff. And, but there were these great, like, beautiful scenes about a guy struggling with the destiny that he had been presented. I was like, this is a cool story. Like, I mean, games had kind of had stories before this, but like 2003, we were really starting to explore that narrative inside of the interactive space. And I was like, I really want to do more of this. And then this person over here, like Kyle Richards over Terminal Reality, which is another Texas-based developer, gave me a chance to come and do stuff on Spy Hunter. And like, we, next thing I know is like, people are calling me for jobs. And I get an agent and they were like, do you also want to do TV and film? I'm like, yes. And so they're like, go down to Houston. They're casting for this pilot. I was like, okay. So I drove 5 hours to go to this pilot. I get that. That leads to me getting onto a movie. That movie led to me getting onto another movie. And next thing I know, it's like, hey, dude, there's some opportunities that are opening up for you in LA. There's people that are saying, if you come out here, we can actually give you a real big run at this. And
that's awesome.
It is, but it's also like, you can't, there's no like, okay, so here's the way that you do that.
Yeah.
You
know? There's no way to manufacture that.
No, you go, okay, find your Dave McGarry who's going to let you be in a Gearbox game, but make sure that this is 20 years ago because that's the way that it works. And so now it's a completely different, there's nothing, I don't know how to tell somebody other than the commonality that I see with everybody that's continued to be successful in this. And by success, what I mean is they're able to do this as their number one thing and they're continuing to do it and they're getting better and better and better every time. And that's the one thing I can at least look at is like, I feel like I'm not showing diminishing returns, but I feel like I'm a better actor than I was the previous. And I'm a better one than that one. Is that there's this freedom to fail and we have to be brave enough to fail. It's like, I have no idea if this is going to work, but I'll give it a shot. And someone believing in you. And that only comes from relationship, working with people enough and being given a small role. And they go, well, he didn't screw that up. Why don't we give him a bigger role? And he didn't screw that up. Let's give him a bigger role. So, I mean, that's kind of my origin story, but I didn't really pop until like 2009. And that was when, I guess it was 2008. When Jack Fletcher, who has since become a dear friend and a mentor to me, risked his job, put his job on the line because he said that I needed to be Snow in Final Fantasy 13. And I had auditioned for it, I think, but I had auditioned for, I got the role of Cid. And I was like, cool, there's a Cid in every Final Fantasy. This is dope. I get to be the Cid for this game. And he goes, no, he's actually better suited. I know who would be better at Cid. And it was this power play with Square Enix at the time going, either you're going to trust me and you're going to trust my casting choices or I'm out. And he was like, either you hire him or I'm gone. And they went, okay. And so I walk into my first session and Jack Fletcher looks at me. And if you've never encountered Jack Fletcher, he's this leftover hippie from a bygone age. The man just was born of and for and probably wishes to remain in the 60s. He knows more about jazz than I will ever know. And he's just this beautiful, articulate, poetic soul. And he has this long, gray, curly, shoulder-length hair that sometimes he puts up in a bun. He's a total Berkeley hippie. He's got these square glasses on and everything he says, he's kind of like got this Gore Vidal kind of like loquacious, slow talking mannerisms about him. And I walk into the session. I've never met him before. And he goes, listen, don't fuck this up because both of our jobs are on the line. I was like, okay. And he told me the story. It was like, so I'm banking that you're going to be the right choice. Don't prove me wrong. And he just guided me through and he's just become a super powerful. So again, I don't know how to point someone to that, but it has been,
you can't,
no, you can't. And it has been such a dynamic ride. And that was the first time that anyone really kind of saw me like in a quote lead role. And then it was okay. Now you're leveling up and now you have to get your baddies are going to be bigger and ammo is going to be fewer. We're not going to handhold you as much as we have before. To employ kind of the vernacular of the game industry.
So, you know, obviously, you know, walking down a hall or just lucking into or being at the right place at the right time and having the guts to say, hey, this is something I'm interested in, is a big part of it. And you're right. That's not something that you can necessarily teach someone. Right. Although it seems like everything started with you being bold and saying, hey, this seems really cool. I'd like to check this out. And that's usually good advice.
Yeah. Preparation meeting opportunity. That's luck, right? Mm-hmm. It's when you're putting yourself in a position to where, people know that you're passionate about something. And so they're like, well, I'm in a position to give you that. And I trust that you're going to make me look good. No one's ever going to give someone a chance if they're like, I think you, dude, I can't give you that role because it'll reflect. It's the whole Goodfellas thing. Do you vouch for them? It's like, yeah, I vouch for this.
Yeah.
You know, so if someone willing to vouch for you and like the mafia sense to where they're like, if Jack Fletcher is like, if I screw this up, he and I both are going to end up in the desert and some like, you know, having a cactus grow above us because like Square Enix kills us.
in the desert next to E.T.
I started realizing how terrible of a metaphor that was to use. Square Enix are great people. And I'm not just saying that because I'm employed by them currently with Avengers. I was just using Goodfellas because I love like all of the Martin Scorsese as a director and as a creative, but also just I love a good mob movie, and I love just that kind of code of honor that exists amongst like the reprobates that let's say no matter what you never snitch. You understand what I'm saying? That you never snitch on a friend. You vouch for this guy because you're gonna be wearing the cement boots before too long. I had to do a voice. Sorry, guys.
It's good.
No reason for it whatsoever, but I still did it. That one's
doesn't
free.
Need to be a reason. That's great. Thank you.
So you mentioned along the way that you got an agent, and at what point is that something in today's industry? At what point is that important for up and coming performers? Is there a trigger point? Is there something that says, all right, now is the moment where you really need to have representation?
My believing is this, and I'm fortunate that I have a team that views it the same way. I believe a common misconception among a lot of people that if I get an agent that I'll get the work. It's like, no. An agent doesn't come into play until you have the work. Their job is not to get you work. Their job is to broker that deal that benefits both you and them and the client, because they have to look good for those people as well, right? Because if they sent them someone who's not right for that role, that casting agent or that studio is going to go, we're no longer going to go to this agency because they don't provide us with solutions. So for me, I look at it as we're a team. Like Natanya Rose is my agent, but over the last 6 years that we've been together, I think it has been more of this partnership of she leans on, and I'm also a very different client for her because it's a neck and neck race as far as like who's keeping up with whom, because I am constantly creating opportunities. I'm going out and I'm having meetings. I'm talking to different people because we sat down at the end of every year and she's like, okay, this is what we did this year. What do we want to do next? And I remember I told her one year, I was like, I want a Ben Affleck. She was like, you want to get really, really drunk and put a bad tattoo on your back? I'm like, no, what I want to do. I said, I want to direct something that I'm the lead in. And she looked at me and went kind of the blank stares like, okay, let's do that. Let's figure out how to do that. And then next thing you know, I'm on set and I'm directing all the performance capture for Shadow of War. Mm-hmm. And we set out a goal. It's like, let's look for the right opportunity that's going to allow us to be able to do this. So that partnership that I have with my agent is really, really unique. And I covet it because it's something that has been carefully curated over years of working together. But for me, I didn't get an agent until I could walk in and I literally had a national ad commercial that someone was coming to me going, because of Brothers in Arms, they're like, here's this company, Ubisoft wants to do this national TV spot, and they want to use you for this TV spot. Are you wanting to do this? I'm like, this is out of my league. Like, I'm punching above my weight here. I don't know the rules. I don't know the rates. I don't know anything about this. And so I went into an agent and was like, can you help me broker this national ad, you know, for TV? And they're like, sure. It's a guaranteed win, right? You're obviously going to make some money off of it.
Right.
And so it was a bigger payday because I was able to go through an agent and be able to do that. And then she was like, so who are you? Like, what do you want to do? And she said, are you willing to do this? And next thing I know, I'm going on auditions. But I was also, at that point, I was taking everything that anybody could give to me because I had zero experience. And I found myself on, again, that pilot that I booked. I drove down to Houston. I didn't have the money to do that. I walked in. I had never auditioned for anything before. And I'm in the lobby. And the casting agent comes out, and this is not what you wanted. First of all, I look around the room, and it was for a truck driver. Can't remember his name, and I've said this before on something. Martin Hannell. I remembered. The character's name was Martin Hannell. Completely irrelevant, as much as he was to the entire plot of the show. It was a bad procedural that never got picked up beyond pilot. But we got to shoot a pilot, and I walk into the meeting, and again, it's casting for a truck driver. And I look around the room, and there's all these truck drivers. Oh. And then there's me wearing, like, you know, me. Just not a truck driver. And
it's not your aesthetic?
No, I am at best like truck driver chic. Like if a truck driver wore skinny jeans and decided is like, yeah, I'm 44. I'm going to do a mohawk and bring back my earring that I haven't worn in 10. Sure. That kind of truck driver.
Nice.
And he plays like this lascivious character in the script or whatever. And he's a total plot pusher. He's like, yeah, I saw the guy that did the thing and the cops were interviewing me. That's the whole thing. So the casting agent comes out and I'm looking at this dude right before she opens the door. And there's a guy that's like in a wife beater. And he's wearing overalls and he's like looking at himself. He's like messing up his hair even more. And he's like going over his lines. And I look at his hands and his face and I was like, I know what you did. In the parking lot before you got into the building, you rubbed your hands all over your tires and then rubbed them all over your face. So I was like, man, I didn't know that's what you were supposed to do for auditions. And I'm like, oh, dude.
There's commitment for you.
Yeah, I'm like one step shy from like a briefcase in a suit. Like I'm like a milk bucket under a bowl at this point. I am way out of my league. So the door flies open and there's like this 5'4" brunette. Just, you could tell she's a powerhouse. She is a force of nature. And she doesn't like anybody to give her any shit. And she's like yelling down the hall. She's like, damn it, Michelle, where's my lunch? I'm going to have to go through the next hour of these assholes without anything to eat. Who's next? And I'm like, oh no.
Oh no, it's you. You're next.
Me. And I raise my hand. She's like, get in here. And I walk into the office and she's like, God, she's like still pissed. And she turned on the camera and she's sitting down and she's like, she looks at me. She goes, go. And she like starts messing with her like laptop or whatever. And I'm like, I have one shot at this. And I knew how much it cost me in gas to get down there. And so I just like, I instantly go into the scene and she's not looking at me. And so I'm just staring at her. And the character again was just like this lecherous dude. And she says, I said, go. And she stops and she finally looks at me. She sees me just like looking her up and down. And she realizes, oh, this guy's actually in the scene and maybe I should read with him. And so we go through the scene and we finish. She goes, that was great. You made me feel genuinely uncomfortable. Can you stay for the producers? And I said, yeah. She goes, just do exactly what you just did. And I was like, okay. And so I like hung around Houston for a couple of hours, came back for the producers, met with them, and then like drove back home. And the next thing I know, they're like, you need to come down to Houston. You're going to be here for 2 days or whatever. And I was like, they're going to put me up in a hotel and everything. It was so stupid. And it was on set. And
it's the little things.
It is. I remember this so vividly because it was when Pope John Paul was dying. And so I went to bed and I was watching CNN, and then I woke up the next morning and there's a different color smoke out the out the window. And I was like, oh man, the Pope is dead. And so I remember going to set, and I was like, there's your trailer. And I was like, oh wow, there's my trailer. And I walked in and I had my trailer, and I was kind of looking around. I was like, this is awesome. And then look out my trailer window, and there's Lou Diamond Phillips. And I was like huge fan of Young Guns. And I was like, holy shit, what do I do to go say hi to Lou Diamond Phillips? And he's smoking. I was like, I used to smoke. I quit a year ago. I'm going to go out and get a cigarette from him. And I went out, and hey man, can I bum one of those? He's like, yeah, sure. And we like strike up this whole thing, and then throughout the whole course of this, like he became someone that like became a genuine friend and took me under his wing and taught me a lot.
It's great.
But I mean, I don't know, even know where I was going with that whole damn story. It's just a fun story to tell.
It's a good story.
It's a great story. It's all these little things, but it's the stringing of those stories together that somehow I look back and I go, oh, it was me having an agent, I guess. But it's stringing all those stories together that you look back at some point. I remember where I was. I was on my balcony of my apartment in North Hollywood. And I finally said, these aren't just jobs anymore. This is a career. Mm-hmm. And I owe it to myself and to the thing, to the career, to respect it as such. Because if I don't view this as my career and take it as seriously, how can I expect anybody else to? And so that was the moment where I was like, I need to like stop apologizing for this and trying to overqualify and actually accept the fact that like this is a career and I love what I do and I'm proud of what I do.
Man, that's rad.
That's a really interesting story. I mean, it's interesting because we don't normally hear this kind of perspective in the game industry because we are so focused on the nuts and bolts of development. And for Mike and I especially, we're very focused on like the financial angle and how all of these pieces fit together in the broader spectrum. So it's really cool to be able to see it from a creative's perspective and coming in and really giving a game life, really. So, you know, and building on that, I'm really curious, you know, how long are you typically working on a game in which you are the principal character or a principal character?
It's really going to vary dependent upon the game. Like if you take a game that's going to be obviously as narrative based and story driven as a game like The Last of Us, it's not even a one-to-one because here's the same franchise, right? So you go, okay, Last of Us 1, it's about this big and we know how long it's going to take. So it's going to take us this, you know, however long to do that. From the time of development was like 5 years, I think, for Naughty Dog.
I think so, yeah.
Ashley and I shot for 2.5 years. And we would on average shoot once a month. And we would come in and we would rehearse on Wednesday and we would shoot Thursday and Friday. And then we'd come back a month later and then we'd start. And then once we started getting enough scenes in the can and they had enough of the game written, then it was time for us to kind of move in and start doing more of the end game dialogue. And Ashley was so funny. She was like, oh my God, I didn't even think about it. I was like, yeah, there's only like an hour and a half of cinematics that we're going to do, maybe 2 hours of cinematics that we're going to do. But then there's all of the, like, as you say, the nuts and bolts of this, the connective tissue. And it was the first time that I'd ever seen a game really tie in. It was like, remember this scene that we just did? This follows immediately after that. And this is how we pick up that conversation. I was like, yo, you're like doing creative editing and thinking about that. Because that's one thing as a gamer that I always hated. You have this big boss battle and then you'd be in gameplay and everyone was like completely unaffected by what just happened. Or never speaking to what just happened. You're like, all right, that moment's over. Now we're out of the arena and then we're back into the...
We're on to the next moment.
On to the next thing. The music changes and we're, you know... And I was like, this is like really, I could, even before I saw a minute of gameplay, I was like, I can see where this is going to go. And I knew from the very onset when we started working on The Last of Us, I was like, this game is going to be different. I don't know if people are going to accept it or not, because I knew the pedigree that Naughty Dog had, both in caliber of content, but also just in the type of games that they created. I was like, these are people that did like Jack and Dexter, you know, like this is, you know, Crash Bandicoot, like this is what they were doing. So I knew what they're, and of course, Uncharted. So it's like, they do pulp really, really well. They do gameplay really, really well. And they do story really, really well. But they don't do like Cormac McCarthy really, really well. That's not their vibe. So we were, it was an interesting when we first started off with that. But like, you take a game like that, and it's 2.5 years. Flash forward to, and the, working on Final Fantasy 13, we worked on that for maybe 2 years as well, just solid recording. Two different types of processes of how we did that, because Final Fantasy was, they did all of the mocap in Japan, and I did just the VO here in LA. So different processes. Last of Us, obviously, full performance capture. We're capturing full motion of the characters. Face was done later for that one. For two, obviously, we did facial, but then all of the audio was captured, and like 90% of what we got on the stage was in game. Like, we just, that's, it was good enough. We shot it like we did a film. Build sets, interacting.
That's amazing. I actually didn't know that. I didn't know that the sets were fully built out.
Fully built out. So it's like, you start here. There's a door that you're going to run through, slam the door closed. Remember, you got to move around the couch that's right here. You duck down behind over here. There's a window here that we need you to jump through. And so there's rudimentary sets that they built so that you're kind of like a grayscale animation. Like, you can kind of see there's some geo that's built and some polygons that are moving around that represent everything.
Got it.
And then ultimately we're going to build that out to where it's the level of fidelity that you expect from a game from like Naughty Dog.
That's but so interesting.
It's super fascinating. And it helps as an actor for you to come in. And by the way, it's incredibly expensive. Like, just to give you an average cost, and this doesn't necessarily mean for Naughty Dog, but when I was a bit more privy to this when as a director on Shadow of War, to find out, here's a big, big, big game, huge epic scale. And on average for us to shoot, it was about $50,000 a day to shoot. Because to be on stage with that amount of people, the crew that was required, and just all of the cost that goes into it, it's about 50 grand a day. So that still could be comparatively way cheaper than it is for a TV or film production. But it's still, that ain't chump change. And the beauty of that is that I can shoot six to seven pages a day of script in a day, on a 10-hour day, not even a 12-hour day, but like a 10-hour day, I can shoot 6 to 7 pages. Typically on a TV or film production, you're talking a 12, if you're lucky, 12-hour day, or a 16-hour day, depending upon where you're shooting, and you're maybe going to do 3 to 4 pages. So we shot 118 minutes in about 5 weeks of shooting. Off and on for Shadow of War. We were booking, and there were a lot of big set pieces that we had to do. Like, there was one scene that had like 8 sword, you know, different stunt players, including our principal character as well. So we had like 12 people on stage.
That sounds like so much fun.
It is a blast to see. And I had an incredible stunt coordinator that was there, who's an amazing weapons master as well. And his wife is actually the one who's the best at swords, but Tom was the best that I could do. He wanted Michelle, his wife, to be there. Tom Williams, who has stunt coordinated for Netflix shows and Punisher, and he's legit. And he helped me so much with being able to use a sword. And I brought him in. I was like, can you ballet? Like, can you choreograph this entire scene? And we had this one badass scene where Tali and my character, you know, is fighting and gets taken to task. And then El Tario, the female protagonist, comes forward and just like eviscerates these wraiths. But I had all these guys moving in as a oneer, and it was just amazing to watch that ballet. So the money is well spent, but it is still incredibly, incredibly expensive. But to speak to your original question, it's going to vary. By and large, I will be if I'm a lead in a game, with an average dev cycle for most games, this time being anywhere in the neighborhood of like bringing in actors and being able to shoot them, that's about 24 to 36 months on average. Wow. That's a long, that's about the average that it is. If it's less than that, it's probably a smaller scoped game or a smaller scoped role. But there's going to be like, we shot Last of Us Part Two for, you know, 6 years. A lot of that was because of taking time to focus, shift focus to Uncharted 4. And then picking up, you know, Last of Us, after that, because that's what the studio needed to do, right, to get the game out the door. It just really, really varies. Everybody's looking for a silver bullet of how to do this. And performance capture is not necessarily the path for every studio. If you're doing a AAA mm-hmm. console title like Last of Us or Ghost of Tsushima or Avengers or something like that, it's great. But like Telltale was putting out huge, rest in peace, was putting out great quality games, and with pretty much just reskinning. And I think they had at that time maybe 150, 200 people total working yep. at Telltale. And yeah. you would, I would be on a call and be like, oh, we have the writer from Minecraft that's now on this episode of Batman. We actually worked together once on when we were doing Borderlands, and they had just this rotating people. So they rotated people throughout and kind of kept mm-hmm. the department heads. They kind of functioned a little bit more like a TV studio. But that was just VO, and then throwing that into their animation machine, sure. Which is fairly rudimentary because it was made sure that they could do it across all platforms and crank them out super, super fast.
Yeah, the Telltale tool when it was introduced was really impressive and definitely was showing its age there at the end, which is why they were about to move to Unity right before
they
collapsed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's just mismanagement. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm. I this is twice you've mentioned Shadow of War, by the way, and yeah. I feel so stupid for not mentioning Talion in the intro and specifically mentioning your role.
Hey man, in your combat defense, director, there's a lot to mention. So
I know, but that one seems like a big one because that was like a whole new avenue for you doing the performance direction.
Dude, it was, and honestly, with a few years now removed to be able to actually speak to a lot about that game, that team at Monolith, first of all. There's been some great moments throughout gaming history where people were like, all right, the last one to ship the game, turn out the lights. And sometimes that ends poorly with a game like Saboteur, where they literally ship the game and close the studio. And that's happened several times. Speaking of Telltale, they did the exact same thing. But then there's other ones like Final Fantasy, where it's like, this is our Final Fantasy. This is our last game we're going to make. It's a Hail Mary, and it just explodes. And that was the same thing with Monolith. Like they were hurting. They hadn't shipped a game in a long time. They had this licensed IP that Warner Brothers had given them. And they were like, maybe this will work. But the best thing about that game was the creative vision that especially Michael DePlatter and everybody else there at the team had of like, what if we really create an emergent game that allows the player to build their own narrative? And we do that within the safety of the world and the context of the Lord of the Rings. And so it's not just, it's a little bit on rails, but we also don't make you play as Aragorn. We don't make you go to but we create this new character that then became canon. And right. everybody in the industry, we became the band that the other bands like listening to, you know, it was a really, really cool feeling when we were at the DICE Awards and every award that they got besides Game of the Year, which is funny. Every award that they got, we were surrounded by our colleagues and compatriots that were cheering us on. They were like, I love your game. So we were set up for success, and that game went through multiple iterations. Shadow of Mordor went through multiple iterations. Mm-hmm. Originally there was no story, and then it was, here's some story, but it was just going to be VO. And then it was like, well, what if we do full performance capture? And we literally shot everything within like 3 weeks. It was down and dirty. And there's so much of the story that got scoped. There was this whole thing about my father-in-law, that great scenes that got cut, the original way that Talion was going to be presented was that I emerge from a body or a pile of bodies and realize that I've died. And it was just this really, really cool thing. The Christian Cantemessa, who came from Rockstar, he worked on Red Dead, the original Red Dead Redemption, he came in as the director and the writer and created this great, great, great story, especially super, super fast. Like they had to like, mm-hmm. give us your story, let's shoot it and let's go. It was done at the end of the development cycle. So we were pretty much polishing those scenes and then throwing them in engine and going gold. So then you cut to Shadow of War and they're like, oh shit, now we have a success on our hands. It's that whole thing about, I always have a tendency to kind of draw analogs between games and music, but it's like that band's first album was like, holy shit, what a great new band, do that again. And then the second album comes, and regardless of what you think of Coldplay, there's a fantastic story that Chris Martin told, and this is anecdotal, but when they did Parachutes, that was like, I mean, man, they had all the time. There were some demos that they threw on that. Nobody knew who they were. It was their first album out. He spent a lot of that album walking around Hyde Park and writing it. We live in a beautiful world. He's just writing stuff as he goes, but he had no pressure. And then that thing blew up. It started winning Grammys. And then they're like, hey, you got a big deal. And now you need to do another album. And he wanted to quit because he was like, I can't write another album. And he called the drummer up one night, and he was out. And he called the drummer up one night. He's like, you're not going to believe it. I just finished the album. It was like a total rush of blood to the head. And that's that second album, which is a huge leap forward for them. So you have this huge pressure now as Monolith. They go, oh God, now we have a game of the year, which automatically means to the studio and to the publisher, do it again.
Yeah.
Give me more money.
Replicate the success.
But you better. Yeah, exactly. It's like, you better do this again. So like everything had to be bigger. The world had to be bigger. The story had to be bigger. The production had to be bigger. Everything had to be bigger. But ultimately it was like, no, just do it again. It was a problem that I had with Assassin's Creed. It was like Assassin's Creed, the first one, was buggy as hell and had so many problems.
Yep, true.
Damn, it was so much fun to climb to the top of that tower, look out over the city, whether you're in Acre or wherever, and jump. And then when you finally got good enough, you could jump from the top of that thing and kill a dude with a knife in your wrist. That's awesome. I didn't need in Assassin's Creed 2 to start buying art from my uncle's villa and fixing it up. I didn't care about that. I didn't care about getting all of Da Vinci's journal pages and every kind of thing afterwards. Is like, just make a good game with good core gameplay and give me a character that I feel like I can embody in a world that I can move around in and a story that is compelling and pulling me forward to the experience, and I'm good. So there was a lot of things, a lot of trappings that Shadow of War had of fear of failure with the burden of success, like you said, kind of going into it. But we, there was that game hit in that point in the industry, and Michael, I know you know this for sure, where it was all of a sudden something that the team really wanted to, they thought that this is a feature that we should have in there, which is the loot boxes and everything else. And here's an ability for you to be able to not just have a different experience. It's like, all right, you can either grind through the world, which is great, but it's not pay to win. It's pay to play. It doesn't mean pay to play. It's just like, if you want these things, if you want these skins, if you can do this, or you can unlock them as you go. And boy, we just got ripped because of that. And then it became unpopular to like us as a game. But if you haven't sat down and played that game, Fort Assaults are, before Fortnite was doing it, Shadow of War was doing it. And it is the most fun thing to recruit and you use as your army. Your enemy, there's nothing better, right, than turning your enemy and making them your ally. So anyway, that's a whole thing. But if you haven't played Shadow of War, give that another go, because
I've played Mordor through twice. I've played part of War. You're making me want to go back to it.
It's one of those games that I could just spend so much time in, because it was a great, it never got old. It never got repetitive. And it was so much fun. So much fun.
I think it's really interesting, both of those games. We assumed, and this is the thing, someone does something innovative and you expect to see it everywhere from every developer and every publisher. And
yeah,
it's
you and I have had this conversation.
Exactly. Nemesis
system.
The
whole thing of like, yeah, but just don't do something different. Bah, you went too different. It's like, well, what do you want from me, man? It's like, do the exact same thing, or you didn't iterate, or it's not... You know what, man? It moved away from too much for that. It's like that's the beauty of, like, trust me, we felt this with The Last of Us. And I can't wait for once people actually play it, right? Because so many people were automatically prejudiced against it, or it'll be awesome. I'm like, play it. Maybe you hate it. I don't know. but I like the notion of people being able to play it and then make a judgment about it.
Sure. Absolutely. It's just, I am still mystified and in awe of the fact that nobody else has done the Nemesis system. Nobody has gone down that path of emergent gameplay, dude, in the way that Shadow of Mordor and Shadow of War have.
This was literally a conversation I was having with Lana. Same, bro. And I don't know if people were like, no, we can't because they did it, and now we feel like we'll be weird. Or if it was just one of those things where you're like, we don't know how to crack that nut. I have no idea.
I have a feeling that it was a technical thing.
Yeah.
On top of everything else, is you don't, with the Nemesis system, it would feel like it was shoehorned in to pretty much any other kind of game. I think that what Shadow of Mordor and Shadow of War did so well was make you feel like you were immersed in this world and immersed in, you know, taking down these horrible little orcs and these bad guys. And it was never the same experience between people. It's just like, oh, hey, I had to go take this guy down. What was your playthrough? What did your playthrough look like? Oh, man, I had to go take this Uruk-hai down, and it was rough.
Dude.
Avenge me.
One of my favorite moments, though, of the entire game was, I don't know if you experienced this, it only happens in Shadow of War, but so there was, and I'm drawing a blank on his name right now, which I feel terrible because he deserves to be remembered. But there was one of the senior management in Monolith during production got cancer and passed away.
Yes, it was Mike.
His last name. It's he has such a unique last name, and everybody called him by his last name. I feel terrible for not remembering this right now, but.
Everything's a lot right now.
Everything's a lot.
Mike Forgy.
Forgy, there it is. So,
that's right.
My favorite aspect of this entire game was I'm down in Last Stand, and it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, something like that. I've been chasing down this dude that, you know, he was nothing. He was the guy that got coffee. He was like his name's Kevin, like Kevin the Orc or whatever, Kevin the Bone Picker, whatever his name was. And then he became like, you know, Kevin, the leader of all souls. You know, it's just like, because he got a sucker punch up on me, and I've been chasing this guy down. I'm like, oh my God. And he finally turns around and Kevin is going to kill me. And I'm down on Last Stand, and he's got his sword or his axe above his head, and he's about to take me out. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes the savior. And it's this barbarian looking dude, and he bumps him out of the way, and he destroys the orc for me. And he was like, "Aren't you afraid, Ranger? You're not dying today." And off he goes, and a trophy unlocks. And that character is Forgy that they put into the game to immortalize him. And it's his likeness and his voice. So it is this, he's immortal now. And understanding the context of that and what just happened in the game, I burst into tears. Now, that's as the director of the cinematics, right? Like, I directed the performance capture, and those scenes were my babies. And so I wanted to craft these moments between actors that narratively made this beautiful, emotive moment. That was something that emerged from the game that was wholly mine, that was crafted by the dev team. You can't duplicate that. And again, it's like my origin story. It's like, I can't tell someone how to have that moment. That you go find your Kevin and let him kill you. So it's totally random. It's the system responding to my game.
Definitely. But there's also the element of what happens in the booth, right? And I remember...
Way to bring it back to focus, Mike. Way to go, buddy.
Woo! I did it. I did not disappoint. I remember this was back before I was at Game Informer. In fact, this was early on in my career. I had just left nonprofits and gearing up for BioShock Infinite. And there were two videos that 2K released about the characters. And they start off with Ken Levine talking about his vision for, you know, from shifting from BioShock, where Rapture was the main character of the game, to BioShock Infinite, where you had Booker and Elizabeth. And it was in that second video, and it stuck with me all these years. It's this emotional video with you and Courtney Draper, who played Elizabeth, in the recording booth with Ken Levine, and he is pushing you both to get an emotional reaction. And he's telling you, and he asks permission to Courtney first. He's like, is it okay if Troy berates you? And she's like, okay, let's try it. And you're off screen. The camera's fully on Courtney. And I feel like what I heard in your voice was a little bit of trepidation, a little bit of uncertainty, but you kind of get into it, and it results in this extremely emotional performance. So how, you know, obviously, you know, there is that magic that happens in the booth, but how do you prepare for moments like that, whether it's Booker or Joel or Talion or any other, you know, character that does have an emotional moment like that? And what happens after you step out of the booth?
Each of those moments, I'm not a big proponent of processes. Because I feel, well, a perfect example, I remember walking into, we were on set for a game, doesn't matter which one it was, but there was a guy, and he was sat in the middle of the stage, and I try to be there, I like being the first guy on set. I like to come in. This was down in Manhattan Beach, so it was about an hour drive for me, but I could get there in like 30 or 45 minutes if I left before traffic. And so I like to get there early, and I get my coffee and I sit down, and then everyone kind of fills in around me, and it's just kind of a good way for me to get ahead of my day. This dude beat me there that day, and I'm looking, and he sat at the table in the middle of the stage, and this guy is wailing, like at a funeral, crying, wailing. And I'm like, what is going on? And no one's saying anything. No one's doing anything. They're just kind of letting him be. And I'm like, what is happening right now? I was like, did this guy like just find out somebody died? I don't know what's going on. And I'm like, what is going on? And then another actor who was the lead walks up and he goes, good morning, everyone. I was like, hey, man. He turns and he clocks what's happening on stage. And the other actor rolls his eyes. He goes, oh, God, he's preparing. And I was like, oh, he is. And this guy was having this big moment where he's like, oh. And finally, they like moved him off set and everything. That guy was in the third scene of the day. Not the first or the second, the third. And in that scene, he didn't need to cry. He wasn't crying. And I was like, oh my gosh. So that's his process, is that he comes in and he leaves all of his whatever. So I'm like, okay, cool. I've learned for me, but I have a great quote. Sir Richard Burton was asked once, Sir Richard, how do you do the acting so well? He goes, it's quite easy. I will give you everything, but if you give me nothing in return, I will take it from you. And the beauty of that is that he understands that the scene is a beast and the beast must eat. And our job as people and actors in that scene is to feed the beast. And if the beast doesn't eat, then the beast will die. So essentially we are zookeepers. We are professional zookeepers. And ain't nobody coming to the zoo to see the zookeepers. They come to see the beast. And so it's this recognition that my job is to adapt to whatever situation. And if I walk in and I'm fully prepared and I know exactly what I'm going to do and exactly how I'm going to feel and what this moment means to me, I have been in a situation before where even Neil Druckmann has called me out and goes, dude, you have not looked. One of my favorite examples of this is the ranch house scene in The Last of Us, which is a beautiful scene. And we did it. We shot it. It was good. But all of us kind of felt like, meh, it was okay. Didn't feel great. And I had not looked at Ashley, and I was so caught up in my own performance until finally she goes, everyone that I've ever cared about has left me, everyone fucking except for you. And she shoved me. And if you notice, like Joel, it's the first time he looks at her. And that to me was me being lost in my own process, me being lost in my own performance because I was so prepared for that scene. So that instance with the, I don't know if a lot of people know this or not. That's that video. And Ken even asked, he was like, are you guys cool if we put this out as kind of a marketing piece? We're like, sure. That's Courtney's audition.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, either did
she. That's her callback. We had auditioned together briefly for like a minute in Los Angeles at a studio. And then they flew me. They had landed on me and they weren't sure who they wanted for Elizabeth. And they flew up two of their top choices. And they said, let's spend a day working on this together. And so in the morning was one person, the afternoon was Courtney. And so Courtney gets in the booth. And Courtney's coming from primarily from a TV and film background. And so this is like weird for her. She's like, okay, I feel like I need more to go off of. This is a huge scene and I'm just in this booth. What do I do? And he was like, and it's a super, super small booth. So we knew immediately that we were going to be incredibly intimate. And then we had to get dirty with each other. Every session was not in that booth, by the way. just to be clear. Thank God. But we spent a lot of time subsequently in that booth. And I tell you what, man, to this day, Ken Levine is a dear friend. I genuinely love that dude and I am constantly impressed and amazed by him. And the person that he has become, even, and he would admit this too, how much he's learned and developed and grown since he shipped Infinite. That game, I mean, damn near broke him. It was just, it was such an ambitious task. That game needed to be a next gen game. You know, there was just so much that game was trying to do. The console at the time and the industry at the time could barely contain it.
Sure. Yeah, that was, and it was right at the end of the generation, pretty much.
It was.
Did it come out in 2013? It came out in early 2013.
2013,
correct?
Yeah, it came out.
It sure did.
February, and Last of Us dropped in June, so it was like it's a big year.
I remember scrambling to finish BioShock Infinite before April 1st because I needed to be out in Minnesota for my first day at Game Informer, and I wanted to have it done. I wanted to be able to engage in conversation about it with my new coworkers because it was clearly going to be the topic. Because I remember talking to friends around the industry, and it was clear when each of them had finished it, just by looking at social.
Yeah.
And the DMs started lighting up like, oh my God.
Yeah, that was definitely my reaction as well. Vivian was not very old at the time. She was only a few months old. So that was my mommy time. Mommy time was BioShock Infinite.
That's fair.
Because I needed that time to myself. And that game is so special to me as a result of it, because I think I binged it in a weekend. I got real into it. Yeah, I got real, real into it.
That's emotionally heavy too.
I needed it badly at the time. Yeah, it was one of those games where it was just, it was cathartic. It was really, really cathartic. I think it might have taken me 3 days to play it. But I played a lot. Like, you should go and ask James about what happened during that time, because he barely saw me.
Oh, wow. You know, what's interesting about that emotional moment is it connects and reminds me of another one, is when you did the stage performance of scenes from The Last of Us. And that was just super impactful. And you don't often get to see that performance translate from the booth and, you know, voiceover and performance capture to live action, you know, performance of these highlights of emotional moments from a game. And
yeah,
for, you know, from your perspective, you know, is there a vehicle, is there an opportunity out there to see more of that from the industry, or is it something that you only get from the rare project like The Last of Us?
No, I think it's by and large becoming a requirement. And I'm not talking about you have to do a performance capture and this is how you have to shoot your scenes and all that. I think that by and large, the gamer today is engaging with and having to be very selective with the games that they engage with because of the amount of time that is required of them. And the sheer financials of it. In order for me to invest as a gamer into a game, I can't spend $600 on games. I can't do one great game every, you know, year, or one great game every month. And then you start having all these, like, it used to be old. Big games only drop in October. Now it's February. No one does. Now it's June. you know, and COVID's pushing everything. So, I mean, people are, they're wanting to have an experience that's not only like a, you put out a 6 to 8 hour game, man, you're risking your Metacritic going down because it wasn't enough. And unless you're like an inside, you're like, oh my God, that's a 2 hour game. And it's just like, it's life changing. It really is. It's one of the most powerful, profound, truly profound games that I've played in a long time. But you take a look at what the gamer is now demanding from their experience, and it better engage with me cognitively, physically, emotively, on all levels, because I need it to be. I, like you said, that word cathartic is very, very true. It needs to somehow reach into my soul, help me become a metaphor or an analog for whatever problem that I've been dealing with in my life, and then through its mechanics, show me that I have the ability to slay that dragon, climb that mountain, whatever it is. And that to me is what a gamer truly wants. And you can't just do that from a mechanic standpoint. You can't just do that from a design standpoint and go, well, I jumped higher than I ever have before. It's like, who am I in this story? And who, let me believe that I'm this person. Well, that requires there to be a great character that's written. Okay, so now our writing has to get better. Well, I have this great character, but I don't really understand the world that I'm moving around. Okay, well, now the level of fidelity within our world, not only from just a pure aesthetic standpoint, but across the board, has to be truly captivating and engaging. That's why that PS5 showcase that they did with Unreal is like, look at the world, look at the LOF that we're showing here. It's like, we want you to know that the worlds that you'll be able to, not only that we can create and that you can explore, are going to be real. And that's what people want. I don't buy the fact that people go, games are escapism. I was like, no, they're not. They are not escapism. These are people going, I don't have impact in my world right now. And I need to know that when I pick up a controller, I have control. It is a controller that I have the ability to overcome obstacles, that I can complete something, that I can make a difference. I don't believe in that notion. The gamers are too savvy to go, I'm just going to turn my brain off and just play something. No, 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 no. Somehow you're processing whatever you're dealing with right now. That's so true. I think that it is a requirement of games. It is a necessity for games to be able to give us, and not every game has to be this big, you know, narrative. Okay, once in the third epoch of the Andor, then we saw that. It's like, it doesn't have to be all of that. But I do believe that there need, look at The Last of Us, man. It is such a simple task. Go get the guns, bring the girl to the Fireflies. Along the way, get a battery for a truck. It's the most simple of tasks. And Neil Druckmann is a perfect example of a great writer who goes, simple story, complex characters. And most people make the mistake of going, simple characters, complex story. I can't control a complex story, but what I can do is give you really, really layered characters that are moving within a world that you go, well, what happens when this character interacts with this world? And a lot of times the only way that you can do that, the only way that story can be told, is to put it on its feet in a performance capture stage and to bring in these level of actors that are able to really give, like you said, give life to these characters. But then my boy Mike Bithell can throw out Thomas Was Alone and you give me a rectangle, a square, and a triangle, and you bring me to tears.
That game is magic.
It is absolute magic. My wife is not a gamer, but there's been two games. There's been more than that, but like Journey... come on. I mean, you give me Journey, Inside, Thomas Was Alone, Gone Home. Like, there's simple games that, and you look at Gone Home, it just from a pure, you know, aesthetic standpoint, it's like that game came out in 2002. you know, it's just not like this groundbreaking. The performances are, you know, they're good, but they're not like, oh my God, I can't believe the, but it's the story and the world and the experience that you gave me. But it hit me on such an emotional level because it's just constantly unpeeling back the layers of learning who I am in that game.
And it it consistently subverts expectations and tropes and kind of turns itself on its own head, where you keep expecting that something is going to like jump out at you or that you're going to end up, you know, dead in the basement or something like that. Well, at least that's what I was feeling.
Well, and by the talks about pace, it was like, well, the pace of the game is so slow. I'm like, you're controlling the pace.
Yeah, exactly. If you wanted to move through the game quickly, you definitely can. I've played through Gone Home at least a half dozen times because I was just so curious about the different ways that the game would function. And, you know, I've been playing games my whole life, right? Games have been an integral part of who I am for the entirety of my life. And I'm always curious about how games that really affect me emotionally, like why they affect me emotionally like that. Like, why is this so significant? Why does this feel either as bad or as good as it does? And you want to look at Journey. Journey is legitimately one of my favorite games of all time. That game brings me to tears every time that I play it. And we're talking like tears of sadness and tears of ecstasy. That sand surfing level, get out of here. Like, yeah, I don't even understand. I don't even understand why that particular moment in that game feels so unbelievably incredible, but I keep going back to it over and over and over again. These are the things that people care about.
Yes. And it's, but also just to that King Companies, their ability to understand design so well. It's because of the scenes, not even scenes, but like the level or the part of the game, it sounds so reductive to call it that precedes that and follows it, makes that what happens before the sand surfing scene, it's such a payoff. But then retroactively, what follows after that makes that feel like this. Oh, can you remember just when it was so simple and fun? And it was just.
Can you imagine the exhilaration in this moment followed up by this, you know, this crushing despair?
Yeah.
And this dread, right? That's definitely how I feel about Journey. And I think that you're right. I think that, you know, what people are looking for is they're not looking to escape. They're looking to process the world around them and games. Games are art, right? If we talk about games being art, they have to be art through and through and through, which means that when people engage with art, they do it in different ways and they do it for different reasons. But art brings us together and games bring us together.
Agreed.
So, but on that note, you know, we're talking about the importance of emotional connection and why performance capture is so important in that. But we can't do that without talking about what happened in 2016, right? With SAG-AFTRA.
Sure.
And yeah, I mean, if we're gonna go for it, let's go for it, right? And just to give, you know, our listeners a bit of a primer here, you know, the union representing voice actors went on strike over a number of issues, including safety, in 2016. It was like Mike talked about it extensively in his work. In 2016, I don't think I had a place to write at in 2016, so I wasn't talking about it anymore but Twitter. But I want to know how things have improved since then. You know, how have things improved since SAG-AFTRA negotiated that contract with publishers? And what can the industry do? So what can developers do and creators do to help better protect the health and safety of performers?
The number one thing that everybody can do is educate. The lack of knowledge will only result in fear. And fear fear is the path to the dark side.
Exactly. You know? Thank it you. Is, I was about to say that.
It is. I got your nerd quote right there. Mm-hmm. It is by and
it's
large.
It's all nerd all the time here, just so you're aware.
There was such a, man, that I hated it because it was an us versus them. And the reality is that we're partners. And the fact that they were just constantly seated across from on the opposite side of the table as opposed to, The funny thing to me was like, you know, actors going against developers. I was like, do you understand that you're picking a fight with professional problem solvers? Like their job, the reason why they do what they do is go, they literally deal in even the lowest level of people there in QA, not lowest level as far as just saying it's like their function is to find bugs and eradicate them. And there's so much of this that you can look at and say, we have a problem. A problem is, how do we put story into games? Okay, here's a solution. If that solution is no longer viable, then it's no longer a solution, and we will find a different mm-hmm. solution into it. It's like, so let's not try to work oppositionally towards this, but let's partner together and go, how can we do this together? I do not believe in anything that I'm not deserving of anything. And it's not because I'm being aw shucks about it. It's like, this is a hard job. You have to work hard at it. No one is going to give you anything. And ultimately, we are all in business for ourselves. Mm-hmm. I believe that it is important to have some form of infrastructure and people that are able to advocate on your behalf to go, here is a system of practices that is beneficial to both people, because we have educated ourselves about this side of the equation and about this side of the equation. And we understand both. And this is how we feel both can work together. Is that agreeable to everybody? Mm-hmm. Yes. Are you a viable solution? Yes. Are you a viable career? Yes. Okay, move forward. But for me to go, I've never been in a situation before where I have felt endangered. I've never found myself in a situation where I have been forced to do something I didn't want to do. Because ultimately, and again, maybe this goes back to the dude that didn't understand that you were supposed to wear overalls and a wife beater and rub your hands on tires and put them on your face.
It all comes back to that pilot.
Yeah, dude. If someone has ever said, you have to do this, I go, oh, watch this. And I'll take the headphones off and I'll leave. And more than anything, nobody knows what my limitations are better than me. No one's inside mm-hmm. my body, inside my head, and knows what session I had yesterday, what session I have tomorrow or later that day. And me going, dude, truth be told, I can't do this. I'm going to blow myself out. I remember we were doing the Joker, booked for a 4-hour session. We would get 2 hours or an hour and a half in, and Amanda Wyatt, dear friend and a great director, goes, you're done. You're done. I'm starting to hear it in your voice. Mm. And what mm-hmm. we really care about is making sure that we have a great game. Now, that's me going, I'm afraid, and I'll tell you this the truth. I thought I was going to get fired at the end of every session, because I didn't believe that I deserved that role. I didn't believe that I turned that role down twice. And it wasn't until Ames Kirchen, who at that time was head of Warner Brothers Games, was like, look, man, we're saying that you can do this and we're really smart. So get over yourself and take the gig.
I remember you talking about this and how nervous you were about taking on that role.
Nervous. I was nervous and I was fearful. I was afraid that I couldn't pull it off.
It's a really difficult role. I can't imagine ever sinking into a role like that as an actor.
Hell yeah. And the main reason why was, again, because of my personal experience. Somebody else is like, oh my God, I laugh so well. The only reason why I didn't want to do it is because the only job that at that point I've ever been fired from was me laughing, and I couldn't do it. And I was like, they're going to ask me to laugh and I'm not going to be able to do it. They're going to be like, oof, you're fired. And then I didn't just lose a job. I got fired from being the Joker. Huh. My ego couldn't recover. Nobody would ever know. Nobody would ever know. They would get a new actor in there. It'd be great. I would always know that I was supposed to be the Joker in Arkham Origins, and I couldn't pull it off because I couldn't laugh. All of this fear. What I needed mm-hmm. to do was educate myself and go, can you please show me the proper way to laugh? And someone would go, yeah, dude, of course. But I had to educate myself, and I had to admit my own limitations and partner with people and let people know, like, just to let you know, I'm not really good at this. I'm willing to give it a shot, but I know that Jack Hole over here or whatever could do a lot better job of laughing. But I grew up reading this comic, and I know this character inside and out, and I really feel like I do a good job. If you'll be patient with me, and maybe we can't go 4 hours every time, but if you're down for that, then I think we can really do something with this character, and we can hopefully move it forward a little bit. That there's no regulation or bylaw that can be written for that. And there never will be, nor should there ever be. That sure. comes 100% off of an actor walking in and understanding that they are a cog within the wheel of the machine, and they're there to be in partnership with the dev. They're not owed anything. They're not deserving of anything. It's all of us are doing, I pick up my oar and I row on my side of the boat, and you pick up your oar and you row on your side of the boat. And together we're going to bring this thing to shore. But I can't expect someone to write a law saying you must ask an actor, how do they feel about laughing? It just, those conversations, we can litigate this thing to the nth degree, but ultimately it comes down to how can we partner? And my job, I love this. Ian McKellen, I think it was, no, it was Ian McKellen or it was Gary Oldman. I think it was Gary Oldman sat down and for a meeting, they were bringing him on, and it may have been something like Polar Express or one of the ones that he did with Bob Zemeckis, whatever. But he sat down and he goes, gentlemen, how may I be of service? And I was like, that's it. How may I be of service? And that is the, at least the posture that I try to take every time I walk in, is understanding that, yes, there are people behind me that will protect me if ever I find myself in a situation where my values are being compromised. But now the beautiful thing about all of that, to have all of that said, is that there was a level of awareness on both sides of actors going, oh shit, I really need to be thinking about this. It is up to me. This is my business. This is my voice. It is my body that I have to make sure that I know my limitations and are vocal and feel comfortable about doing. And now there's been a conversation about it. So I do feel even more safe to go, just let you know. Now you understand. Because most devs, not malicious. They're not just trying to. They're not like the bunch of Hitchcockian people going, you know, actors are props that eat. They just think that we're superheroes because they've done a session with Steve Bloom before, who can scream and growl and has that voice for 4 hours, or Fred Tatasciore that can do that. And I'll never forget the first time hearing Fred go, man, my voice is really rough today. It was like seeing Xerxes bleed. It was like, oh my God, he's not this deity. He actually is human. But even people right. like that do creature sounds for a living, they go, man, if you ever seen Fred Tatasciore, Freddie will roll in and he's got his whole fanny pack full of just like elixirs and balms and potions and everything else that he does to keep himself hydrated and keep himself healthy as much as possible. Because ultimately, when you get Fred Tatasciore, even though he's got just the greatest, just natural voice, you'll hear him all over Family Guy. You'll never know that it's him. Because what you get when you hear Fred is the Hulk. That's what you expect Fred to do, or these big creature sounds. So yeah, I love that what happened out of that was the understanding that it needs to be more of a symbiotic relationship that's mutually beneficial, and developers got more savvy to the process, and I think actors got more savvy to the process.
Well, I'm glad that, you know, it sounds like what's come out of it is this welcome. This openness to performers advocating for themselves in that situation.
For sure.
Education in this particular, education in every avenue matters, especially if you're going into a scenario where you're just like, I don't know what I don't know. Well, I mean, if developers don't know what they don't know and the performers don't know what they don't know, it's gonna end up in a clash eventually. So
it's just across the board. What happened?
We
saw even SAG going, we really need to be dedicating more resources and more attention to that. This thing has grown now from just being like, as everybody always employs, just the easiest parallel is just like it's no longer Mario's, it's no longer Boops and Beeps. I'm like, it hasn't been that for 20 years, but it's
no
so
longer
far
Boops and Beeps.
Yeah, it's so far away from that. But everybody in the industry and even outside the industry stood up and noticed, is like, oh, that's right, there's actors in games. I'm like, yeah, and it's actually really respectable. And I think it is because stuff like Uncharted and Last of Us and BioShock, where they're like, you know, these are really moving, compelling pieces, like you said, Amanda, art. And they're worthy of our respect, and we should treat them as such. We have to be careful and cautious with how we do these.
And, you know, obviously when you're in the booth, there's dialogue. There's that rapport that you've got with the director. There's other actors in the room. Right now we're in a situation where I can't imagine you've gotten into a recording booth in the last little while here.
Homie, the beauty of my profession, and again, we deal with professional problem solvers. Day one, it was, can you do a test with Sony? Can you do a test with Disney? Can you do a test with Warner Brothers? Can you do a test? I'm either in a session or testing for one almost every day. I had to beef up my rig at home. And we make it work, man, because ultimately again, these are huge productions, and I'm grateful that I work in an industry, because I have a lot of friends in TV and film, and like people that were in Atlanta, they're like, I'm home and we don't know when we're going to shoot again. And TV and film is trying to figure out, oh shit, how do we keep doing this thing? And fortunately, like I've got gear that's being delivered to my house tomorrow to get me ready for a session the following day. And it's like, we figure it out. And there's shows and there's games that I'm doing from my, like my booth that I've built in our spare room in our house.
That's amazing.
It is. And it's fun because I get to engineer myself by and large. I did this thing for Netflix and they're like, we're going to send you the copy. Just direct yourself. You're fine. Shoot it up, shoot, you know, upload these files to the Dropbox or whatever. And we're done. I'm like, cool. The downside to it though, is that most of the booths or the stages that I'm used to working on have exponentially better air conditioning than I do. I like, you're even hearing kind of a little bit of the whirring of the fans that I have cooling off of the gear that I have in here. But it get hot. It get real hot up in here. So there's been some sessions where I'm grateful and they're like, are we doing video for this call, guys? Like, oh no, we can just do audio. I'm like, kick ass, because boy's gonna be in shorts. That's it. So if that, I'm not even gonna tell you what games or projects that has been for, because I don't want to ruin the character for you. Because like, Troy did that in his skivvies to avoid keeping himself from passing out. And it's funny because we can be like, hey guys, I gotta open up the door and just kind of get some air. They're like, yeah. So everyone has been so accommodating, and we use Zoom, we use Skype, we use the advent of incredible new platforms and tech. But I'm grateful to be working in an industry that's able to look at problems like this and go, we got this. This is just a boss battle for us.
I hope that Square Enix has sent you a nice pair of purple shorts.
Purple shorts, man. And the beauty is, they're like, if you want to make your hair match, go for it. They do the best merch, man.
Man, if you show up, actually with green skin, though,
this is the beauty, though, man, is that I remember sitting down with Shauna Sky, who's our creative director and the performance director, and is one of the few people in this industry that functions like a true film director on a game set. Because typically it's like, well, no, I'm just the game director. But that's the cinematics director over there. And there's going to be the performance capture director over there. And there's the animation director. And it's like this weird kind of, there's not really a term that is a one-to-one for how film or TV functions within a game, because it's a big team effort. But Sean is the guy that he like created the story. He's a guy that's by and large, like really setting up his shots. He's directing it. He's going to edit it. He's functioning like a true or like a typical conventional film director. But he came to me and he was like, I want you to play Banner. I was like, okay, you know that I'm Hawkeye. He's like, I know, man, but I really want something special I want to do something different with Bruce Banner. And I was like, I've never been the Hulk. And he's like, no, you're not going to be the Hulk. And I went, what? He was like, I don't want you to be the Hulk. I want you to be Banner. And I was like, go on. And so from the very, very on, these are the meetings that I love. And by and large, they're happening more and more, where there's not really a situation. There's times when it's like, hey, do you mind auditioning for this? And I don't have a problem auditioning, because people are like, I've never heard you do this before. But by and large, when people go, we want you to audition, I'm like, cool, totally down to do that. Before we do that, are you comfortable with us having a meeting? And I want to get on the phone with you. I want to fly up to the studio or come over to the studio, whatever it is. And I've even done that in some cases. Like, I'm willing to fly myself up there to meet the team. I want to get a sense of what the game is, what the character is, what the story is. Because, and I've left meetings like that before where I go, I'm not your guy. To be really, really honest with you, I know what you're looking for, but you really should cast this person as that. I'll never forget Christian Bale originally was cast as, I think he was John Connor in Terminator. And he goes, nope, I want to be Reese and you need to get somebody else to play this because I want to be this character. Or he was Reese. I can't remember what it was. Anyway, didn't matter. But he had this sense of himself of going, I won't play that character as well as somebody else will, and I want to be this character instead. And there's been people throughout like film and TV history and even games history that you kind of look. Steve McQueen was the same way, where he showed up on set to Great Escape. And he had his script and it was all red marked out because there were these big monologues when he goes into the cooler. And he was like, I will give you eyes. And I will read the lines that I feel this character would say, but this guy's not going to speak unless he really needs to talk. And there were these big monologues whenever he went to the cooler. And instead, what do we get now? It's just a montage of him throwing the baseball against the wall. And that was McQueen going, I'm not going to talk. So I try to have that understanding of like more than the what I want to do in this and what will make me look good. There's a beast that needs to eat, and mm-hmm. our job is to feed that beast. And this is the way that I can best feed the beast. But I because I believe this is such a partnership with devs, it's to me, I've tried to go, let's sit down and let's talk about the character. Let's talk about the story. Let's talk about what it is that you want me to do. And if I feel like I can do that, now that I have some direction from you, then it's a little bit more guided. Because otherwise, I'm going to go in my booth or I'm going to go in front of a camera and I'm just going to kind of go to rub my hands on tires and put it over my face. And maybe this is what you want. So I try to avoid that as much as I can, because ultimately, all I'm trying to do is feed the beast.
Well, and it's got to make it a lot harder to feed the beast when you're not able to actually do that performance capture. So how are you coping with that portion of things?
We're figuring it out. Yeah, that's about all that I can say. They're getting real creative. Some of it,
I bet.
There have been some projects where I was supposed to not be here right now, and I was supposed to be somewhere else on set for like a couple weeks shooting. And we're not able to do that. And there's some projects that are like, we're just going to have to make this be something different. And I'm like, I totally understand. And again, I applaud an industry that's able to be as agile, and flexible, as this, and fortunate that they're still willing to give me a shot. Cause they're like, never mind, we're just going to kill the character or whatever. But I don't know. We'll see how long this continues. On some projects, it's getting to the point where they're like, we have to do something different. Other people are like, we'll wait. We're willing to wait because we believe nobody does. Again, it goes back to the sheer cost of it and what it does, how it scopes your game to do performance capture is so intense. And not only just the throwing money at it, but it's building your pipeline. Right. It's like when you mm-hmm. go, our pipeline is going to be this, and this is what it looks like for us to get these performances in engine and up and running. To go dismantle that, and now we're going to completely that costs even more money than just shooting it. So it's actually better to slip and have that pipeline stay in place and go, we'll do everything else. Because trust me, there's always something that needs to happen on a game. You can always iterate. You can give another pass of that level, of that environment, and make it even better and polish, and then add the actors in. So that's what, by and large, most people are doing. And we'll see how long this continues. And again, just kind of like what happened with the strike, the best part is that it's drawing attention to parameters and infrastructure and safety regulations that should be in place. We should always wash our hands, right? Being able to have a focus and attention to how we interact with each other and the fact that we are all connected and that we have an impact on each other. And if someone's sick, don't come here.
Right.
Which by and large, that happened a long time. Like, fortunately, this community is pretty savvy to where if somebody walked in, I was like, sorry, guys, I'm so sick. You're like, don't you ever come into, because like we all will get sick. And it doesn't matter how we feel. It's how we sound. So if you come in here with a cold, man, you're odd man out. Most people are like, I have a sniffle and I'm not going to come into that room. They're like, thank you. Thank you so much. It's an incredibly mm-hmm. respectful industry.
Oh, yeah, it will be nice to see some of those things be the norm now, like not pushing people to work when they're sick because of the impact on the people around them.
Yeah.
Productivity isn't that important for one person if they're risking knocking out a dozen, right?
Right.
Oh, man. So just our last question here, just to wrap up. Two parts of it. What are the biggest challenges that voice actors and performers face right now? And what advice do you have to those who are entering the field in terms of preparing themselves as much as one can prepare for those moments that make a career? What can they do for themselves?
That is the best thing to identify, or what are my obstacles going to be? And to be able to have the kind of the beautiful fraternity that this industry specifically has, of being able to go talk to me about your challenges. What challenges did you face? And this is what we've been doing the entire time as a species, is being able to go, just to let you know, over there is danger, but over there is food. And like trying to somehow communally lead ourselves to greener pastures and a better place, this is no different. And I think being able to be okay with what you don't know in the pursuit of trying to change that, and saying, how can you educate me, is one of the biggest challenges. There's so much fear. And because even still that this is a burgeoning part of this industry, there's a lot that's not known, and we're constantly figuring it out. And we pretty much had this console generation figured out, and then a new console generation came. So everyone's trying to figure it out now. It's constantly evolving. And so to throw yourself into that washing machine a little bit and to just go with the flow is actually will serve most people way, way better than going, this is the way that it has to be done, and this is the way that I want to do it. But by and large, what I would say is that it goes back to a lot of lessons that I learned. This is my business. It is my dream. It is the SS Troy's dream, and no one else is the captain. And if it goes down, by and large, there could be people that lament its, you know, demise, but it's going to just be me that goes down. Therefore, it's up to me to keep it afloat. And I do that by partnering with other people. I do that by learning from other people and engaging with other people and understanding that it's a spirit of partnership that I'm able to stay afloat. I think that, like we've continued to say, educating yourself as much as you can. Yes, study. Yes, go to classes. Yes, learn what you can. It's about finding your inner voice and not your external voice, more than anything. So many people focus on, I could do these great accents. It's like, awesome. By and large, I never do accents. Mike Bithell, I always joke because I'm always trying to do a British accent with him. He never let me do one. He's like, what if
Killjoy,
a British accent? He's like, no, you're not going to do one. It's just be you, please. Come on. So, you know, you can't just rest your laurels on the fact that you can do a funny voice or a good accent or something else. It's like people want to know inherently what you bring to the role. And to that end, understanding that when you walk into, and I don't even call it auditions anymore because that's a whole other separate conversation, but just call it a meeting. You're not trying out. The second that you look at it as an audition and go, I'm going to try out for this role, that is me going in there trying to impress somebody and trying to show them that Troy Baker can act, versus the character. If the character were to walk into that room, they're not trying to prove to anybody who they are. They're just showing you what they look like. They're just showing you what the character looks like. And that's all that we have to do as actors. When we walk into that meeting with the director, the casting director, is we show them what the character looks like and be okay with them disagreeing and going with somebody else, another version of that character. But that's all that I try to do, is I walk in and I go, I know something about this character that nobody else does. And somebody could show you something else about this character that you agree with more. But I can tell you this, the information that you've given me and the story that I see, this is who this character is. And they go, yes or no, yes or no. And I'm fine with them disagreeing about it. But I always just want to show them what the character looks like. That's it. Express, don't impress. I will never be able to, in the same way that guy and the wife beater in the overalls, that's not what they were looking for. Most likely in that script, it wasn't a truck driver out of necessitation of a narrative plot point. It was like, and Martin Handel's a fucking 3 a.m. truck driver. I don't know. It was just a flippant add-on. It wasn't a, and he must be a truck driver. It was like, give him an occupation. He's like, a truck driver. I don't know. It was the fact that the purpose that he served in the story. That is the biggest piece of advice that I would give to everybody is be brave enough to fail. Show them what the character looks like. Express, don't impress. And most importantly, once you get the job, remember that you got the job. Stop auditioning when you get on set. And remember, your one job there is to feed the beast.
Man, I love it. Thank you so much.
Dude, it's my pleasure. I love these conversations, man.
Man, I am so grateful that that you took some time to speak with us. Always great catching up.
Yeah, it's different. Normally, we could have like a normal convert, like normal level of conversation, because normally it's being shouted over the din of either E3 or a bar or something like that. It's like, this is cool.
Yeah.
This has been illuminating.
Yeah, thanks.
I have loved this. This has been, what, episode 25? Did we hit episode 25?
Technically, we hit episode 25 last episode because we did our zero array episode numbering because we're dumb. We're the dumbest people ever to exist.
Yeah, we numbered our first episode zero, and it has been confounding us since then. Oh, and it is a mistake we can never scrub away.
You never ever. Do that.
Never. It was just the dumbest idea. We were so impressed with ourselves at the time. We're like, yeah, self five.
Yeah, it's a pilot. We got this.
This is the greatest. No. Okay, well, that has been episode 25, but technically 26. We really want to hear from more indies. You know, we talk a lot about the indie development scene and making sure that we're taking care of our people and giving back to the community that has given us so much. So if you are an indie developer and you have a game that you are ready to release, if you have a game that's recently been released, if you are on the path to looking for funding, we want to hear from you. We want you to talk to us and be in our indie spotlight. So you can get in touch with us. Our DMs are open at our virtual econcast or podcast at fsquared.biz.
And thank you for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. As Amanda just said, you can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast, or you can follow me. I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I'm at Amanda Farrow. It kills me every single time you spell something.
I spell just for you these days. Troy, where can people find you online?
At Troy Baker VA on the Twitters and Official Troy Baker on the Instas.
Excellent. And if you are new here, you can subscribe. Thank you for tuning in.
And you can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on every major podcast provider that you may have. So that's things like Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Google Play and Stitcher and Pocket Cast and Podcast Addict, and we're everywhere. You can't escape us. We are ubiquitous. The best thing you can do for us is subscribe. It tells the algorithm gods that we are in fact special, and you know, people should be paying more attention to us. And if it's possible, review our show. Let us know what you think. We love to hear from our listeners. If you have any feedback for us, you can also get at us at the usual places, so on Twitter and on email.
And if you have questions for us or our guests, you can DM them to us or send them to podcast@fsquared.biz. Speaking of F Squared, Virtual Economy is an F Squared initiative, and along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way we're working to give back to the community. To find out more about F Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz. That's FSQUARED.BIZ.
Every time. Okay, we will be back soon. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.